Hello. I can hear you. Can you hear me?
I can hear you perfectly. This newfangled technology actually works.
Well, I mean, this is an interesting app. I mean, to record, like, that you could record kind of good quality audio. It's actually giving me ideas for my podcast.
I'm sorry, do we have an announcement? Is there an Elise Labbit podcast that we didn't know about?
Well, there's one in development, let's put it that way.
Totally here for the Elise Labbit podcast. You will have many dedicated listeners.
Oh, I hope so. I hope so. Thank you. Thank you. I'll save the rest of it for the podcast, but it's been, you guys are really, like, I love when I'm on the show and I hear from you. It's really great.
Yeah, it's a very, very dedicated group of followers, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And you have a really, among that fan base, the what we call Pooligans, as a sort of, as a, started as a joke, but then became a podcast instead. There are so many Elise Labbit fans.
Oh, that's so nice. Yeah, we could save that.
All right. We're saving it for the podcast, which we're going to start right now. If it's okay, I'll do a little intro,
sure.
And then we'll get going. We are very excited to welcome every hashtag Pooligans favorite foreign affairs journalist. She is a veteran journalist covering foreign affairs. She's a journalist in residence at Georgetown University, a much adored host on SiriusXM POTUS channel, where she can be found occasionally, and she tweets at Elise Labbit because she is Elise Labbit. Elise, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so excited to have you. And we had breaking news before we started recording this that Elise is actually working on her own podcast. Julie Mason, did you hear that? Elise working on her own podcast. That is something that is happening and clearly honors all podcasts from now on. They will no longer be resented as much as they were previously by one Julie Mason. They will now be adored because Elise has one.
Well, because she'll have to be a guest. I mean, look, I've been working on a podcast for some time. Working on developing one. There isn't really, I think, you know, in the Pooligan, in the press pool spirit, maybe, of something that has just like a real irreverent, approachable look at what's going on, not just in foreign affairs, but, you know, in international trends and not just in national security, which is what we focus on in Washington, but in business and health and in culture and even sports. And so I think that, I've been playing around with an idea for some time, and I'm kind of getting my mojo together to put it on. Name suggestions welcome.
Name for the podcast?
Yeah. What do we want to call? I want to call it? I mean, I've been thinking about a lot of names, but I think your name is really what. There's this podcast generator. There are these podcast generators. I mean, you guys have, obviously Pooligans is. Obviously, Pooligans is untouchable. I mean, that's really a great name because it's talks about your mission. But, you go to these name generators and it's like they all have the same ones. It's like Elise Labbit's Crazy World or.
You might actually want to call it that. That's actually Elise Labbit's Crazy World is actually not the worst.
Or Wild World. Well, if we're gonna do that, it's gotta be like Elise Labbit's Big Fat Juicy World or something like that. But anyway, I'm kind of deliberate in my work, and so, it's been a long time in coming and developing the idea, but we're getting ready to go.
Well, we're going to be excited to hear all of that. And now as a setup, I guess, for that forthcoming podcast, we're now going to do an hour all about Elise Labbit. So you know who you will be listening to, because I feel like in your case, Elise, it's almost euphemistic calling you a veteran journalist. It's true, of course, but I don't think that when you appear on Julie's, you frequently play a game of Julie names a country, Elise tells us all about it. But I think very few people know how you actually came about that expertise and your exact background. And it is really extensive. So if we're just going to roll it back, though, all the way to the beginning, if you would.
Sure.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you grew up, where you grew up, and also what inspired you to want to do this?
Okay. Well, okay. So it kind of started in Marlboro, New Jersey, which is, I like to say that Springsteen country, because that's the town. Marlboro, New Jersey is the town next to Freehold where Bruce Springsteen grew up. Anyway, I was always interested in international international stories in my social studies and stuff like that. And then there was this class called Global Studies, and it was an honors class and you had to apply to it. But I got in, and the teacher was named Mr. Gorman, and he would come into the class with all of these stories and all of these things that are going on in all of these countries around the world that I've never heard of. Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, like we don't, you know, in America, we don't really study a lot of that in social studies. And so, you know, he was talking about all these stories that I heard on, that he heard on CNN. And, you know, cable was just starting off at that time. And I, you know, didn't know what CNN was, but I wanted to work for that CNN one day. And so, you know, I was reading Foreign Affairs well before it was fashionable when I was like a dorky high school kid, because, you know, that was the class. And so when I went into college, I had that kind of international mindset. I don't know why. I went to University of Wisconsin in Madison. I don't know why I originally tried to study business, but I'm really not good at math, as you all know. And that kind of tanked pretty quickly, but thankfully so, because I moved to international relations. And I was also, you know, in high school was interested in the newspaper and the yearbook. And so I ended up doing international relations major, but also kind of minoring in communications and journalism. And so that kind of started there. My first job, I took I went to graduate school at the New School for, at the time it was called the New School for Social Research, was it's now called New School University, but it was really originally created as a haven for intellectuals fleeing the Nazis. So it always had this tradition of kind of, you know, out of the box thinking. And I studied media studies there, and I studied a lot of philosophy, postmodern philosophy. And my professor was devastated when I told him I was going to go work for Fox News. Because here he's like this German philosophy professor. And so that was that. And then I took a class at the at graduate school on the United Nations and World Communications. And that kind of got me interested in international journalism. But my first job in journalism was in a small town in New Jersey. And the paper was called The Suburbanite. And, you know, you don't need to look past. You don't need to look any further past the name to know it was like all about suburban, you know, suburban life. And it was a good training ground. I covered school boards and, you know, council meetings, and even like I covered segregation of schools. So it was really a good training ground. And from there I went on to, you know, work in New York and work for a division of ABC News. And I did some writing there. And then in 2000, I came to Washington to work for CNN as the State Department producer. You know, that then kind of just moved up the ranks from there.
You've traveled, I mean, truly far and wide, over 80 countries. That's a lot of countries.
Yeah.
At the time you began, would you have thought that 20 years on, you would find yourself in the situation that we're currently in? Or is that an odd development?
With the coronavirus?
We have so much, Elise. We have coronaviruses. We have Donald Trump. We have some things, I guess, have changed, and some things really have not.
Yeah. I mean, I think the thing about the United States is I never really thought that we'd have a president like Donald Trump. Not because... I just think we've been taught, we've grown up to think of a certain way in a certain, you know, we've kind of caricatured our, the US president and what the US president should look like, what the US president should say, what the US president should do. I mean, put the policies aside, because every president brings his own policies and you can agree with them or not agree with them, but you know, that comes with any administration. Mm-hmm. So, we'll leave the policies aside for a second. But we've been, you know, kind of, I guess, programmed over the years to think of a U.S. president acting in a certain way. And that's not to say that these type of presidents have not been elected around the world. Like, I mean, I think the maybe the most similar example I could find is Berlusconi
in Italy.
Yeah. In Italy, right? Mm-hmm. But you would have never thought that the U.S. would elect a Berlusconi with a grand personality and kind of, you know what I mean? Like just kind of cult of personality and force. I'm not saying that's good or bad. I'm just saying that I think Americans are kind of very puritanical in terms of what, or I always thought that they were in terms of what they're looking for in a president. And I've been very surprised. And you know, it's been a real reckoning, I think, for the media to realize that we didn't really know what was going on in our country. And, you know, some journalists have kind of, you know, nodded to it and said, oh, well, we ignored the Trump voter. But I don't think that Americans really know the character of America. And I think that's something we're just learning right now.
I would absolutely agree with you. And building on that exact idea of Americans not really being aware of the character of America, it seems that they're even more fleetingly aware of the character of anywhere else, which, considering what they knew about America, should maybe not come as a surprise. But when you travel to 80 countries around the world, first of all, do you have favorite assignments, places that you really loved reporting from or that you found really interesting and compelling? Or are all places the same because it's about the reporting and not the places?
Look, when you're traveling, I mean, everyone thinks it's so glamorous, but like, I'm going to clue people in. When you're traveling with a delegation like the Secretary of State or the President, you're in, it's like airplane, motorcade, hotel, motorcade, foreign ministry or palace, motorcade, airport. You know what I mean? It's not glamorous. You know, maybe
you said palace, Elise. There was a palace in there.
Yeah, but you know, I'll tell you, remind me to talk about Algeria in a minute, but you know, I mean, look, it's a very unglamorous existence. I mean, I think reporters try to get out for a good meal, but there's not a ton of sightseeing or like getting to know the people. So the trips that I've taken that have meant the most to me are the ones when I can get out and meet the people and, you know, see what's going on. So that would be Libya, which I found fascinating. I went around the time Condoleezza Rice went to meet with Gaddafi. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's devastating to see what's happened to Libya since then, but, you know, not the overthrow of Gaddafi, but in terms of the violence and the, war that's happened there. But Libya was a very special country and it's beautiful and it has so much potential and I hope that it reaches it one day. I also have spent a lot of time, you know, on my own reporting from Turkey and Pakistan and Afghanistan and Israel. And those are countries that, you know, and Morocco, you know, I am attracted a little bit more in the reporting aspects to the broader Middle East, North Africa, and those kind of, you know, Afghanistan is just such a special country and each province has its own culture and its own people and its own topography and it's just beautiful. And Pakistan is wonderful as well. And the people are so hospitable. But then I, you know, I spent a week once in reporting in Poland and learning about, you know, the different parts of Poland and the culture and the history and the, you know, kind of remnants of what it's like to be on the border with Russia and still have that fear of Russia. So, you know, I think the most rewarding things to me, and that's what's always been attractive to me, is other cultures, other people, other political systems, other food, other music, other clothing, just like the different cultures. And when you go back to that the Americans don't really know about other places, I think that's true. And I think it's unfortunate, you know, unless you have, you know, unless you're fortunate enough to have money to travel, which not a lot of people do, American education, for one, is not, it's global in the sense as you study the Spanish Civil War, or World War II or whatever, but you're not really studying what's going on in other countries, or at least we didn't when I was younger. And also I think the fact that America, you know, is, you know, isolated and not, you know, close to other countries. There's not this, you know, American education is very America-centric and not truly global. And I find that citizens of Europe, citizens of the Middle East, are far more global in their view than Americans.
Yeah, I would agree. I grew up in Switzerland, so I was shocked when I came here at age 21. The amount of times that I just had to explain to people the difference between Sweden and Switzerland upon them noticing that I was neither tall nor blonde and seemed disappointed has been vast. And that's two European countries. But it seems confounding to Americans. I've wondered how much of that may have been tied into what we have now. This idea of we are just on our own may have actually existed far longer, far, far longer than maybe people generally realized, because like you said, school has always been America first.
You know, when you think back to kind of the seeds of the globalization kind of movement, and a lot of people were left behind. If globalization was something that everybody was invited to take part and like, look at, you know, it opens up the world to everyone in America, then it might have been an opportunity. You know, definitely the education was not, you know, was always very America-centric, but globalization left a lot of people behind. And so the idea of thinking globally, I mean, doesn't suit a lot of people who don't benefit from it. And I totally get that. Mm-hmm. You know, but we all are living in one world, but, you know, why, you know, I do understand, and I, you know, obviously have more of a global view, but I do appreciate and understand, you know, someone somewhere in America, and I won't, you know, stereotype a region, but usually on the coast, people are a little bit more, have more they have more interaction with international, with foreign nationals and different cultures. I would say Middle America has kind of been left behind by the globalization movement. And so why would they, A, care? Why would they be, sympathetic or empathetic to something that's going on around the world when, you know, no one around the world really cared about what was happening to them? So I think since Trump was elected, I've spent a lot of time thinking about that Middle America and how, you know, they have different needs and different challenges, and you know, the globalization movement really, really left them behind. I mean, just like I say, Americans don't really know the character of America. I mean, I'm getting to know it. I'm getting to know it myself. I always thought everybody was like me, you know, I always thought everybody was like me growing up in New Jersey or growing up going to New York City and, you know, going to a, I don't know, Indian restaurant, like, you know what I mean? Like, just because you go to an Indian restaurant and you eat Indian food doesn't mean you know anything about what's going on in India, and doesn't mean that you know anything that's going on in Indiana. So, you know, I think we all have a lot of learning to do.
What do you, conversely, when you traveled around the world, what did you find people's impression was of Americans?
There's two impressions. One is the kind of stereotypical, stupid, arrogant American, and there are plenty of them. Okay, let's be honest.
True facts.
But anybody, true, you know, that is entitled and, you know, but I would think for the most part, people are very nice. They are interested in America. They're wearing their Levi's. They like Michael Jackson. Like, American culture is very, very popular around the world. And so Americans are very popular around the world. But even in countries like Iran, right? It's the governments, okay? It's the governments. And it's not just the governments in America. It's like, you know, you meet Iranian people, they are so nice and so hospitable and everything. And then if an Iranian came to this country, you know, we don't have a negative opinion of, I mean, most of us don't have a negative opinion of Iranians. But the government is what gives us a bad name, you know, and not just, I'm not just saying this government or whatever, it's the policies. You know, unfortunately, we're judged by the policies of our government and not about who we are. And that's probably true of Americans viewing other people around the world. You know, I think we need to, you know, start looking at each other as people and not kind of pawns of other governments. But I've never, unless I'm at a French restaurant and the waiter is like, you know, laughing at my stupid broken French, like, oh, dumb American. For the most part, I've always been treated with like respect and some curiosity too.
Yeah, in French restaurants, you always know that you're on the wrong track when they respond to French with English. Like they have a strong, you're ordering the bouillabaisse and they're
so
like,
true.
I'm sorry, I believe you wanted the bouillabaisse, but I did not completely understand what you said. Please. French waiters.
You know, and sometimes I like you, sometimes I do an experiment. Like I try to like turn them, you know what I mean? And like court them over to my side. Like, for instance, this is apropos of nothing, but, and everyone in Washington, I encourage you to check out this when the coronavirus kind of subsides. I have this signing Starbucks on H Street in Washington, D.C. And it's it might be the only signing Starbucks in America. We have a community, Gallaudet University, which is a university for the deaf. And, you know, H Street has started to employ a lot of deaf students. And so the signing Starbucks, I think there was one in Malaysia and one of the managers came back from Malaysia to America and says, I want to try it here. So, you know, a lot of the community from Gallaudet has now started coming to the Starbucks. And it's like such a beautiful, serene, peaceful place. They will not talk to you. They will only sign or you could write it down. And so I've tried to learn like a few sign language. You know, talk about French. I've tried to learn a little sign language and they just like, I don't know what the hell you're talking about.
Oh, no way. You got nagged
they,
for
but
your
they
signing?
They appreciate it.
Okay, that's good.
They appreciate the effort, but we can have a laugh about it is what I could say. Like in France, like if you don't know how to order your bouillabaisse, like, you know, piss off, right?
Yep.
So.
Yeah, but it's also almost expected at the French bistro. Like when if I go to a French bistro and they don't give me attitude, it feels like they didn't train their wait staff very well. Because that's not nobody
I
is
know.
Here for a friendly yeah. French waiter.
This is not really French.
Exactly.
This is not really French.
I'm gonna get my bouillabaisse right. somewhere else if this is what it's gonna be like.
Right. So I wanna go back to the story I promised to tell you about Algeria.
Yeah.
Because you asked for like a memorable experience. So I was with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and we made a quick stop in Algeria to meet with President Bouteflika. And we go to the palace and it's beautiful and it's gorgeous. And we're waiting while she has her meeting and they treat her and her staff to like this sumptuous feast of like Algerian food, which is fantastic, by the way. And then they usher the press into another room and they feed us. We think we're getting this like huge feast. And they give us like on these styrofoam like trays, like from the airlines or whatever, like something that you wouldn't feed your Bangladeshi servant. Like, I mean, it was terrible. And it just goes to show you how when you travel around the world, what some people really think about the press.
Since you mentioned traveling with Hillary Clinton, then Secretary of State, I said in the intro that calling you a veteran journalist is almost a little bit euphemistic because I think people don't really understand how many secretaries of states or how many dignitaries and how many administrations have you traveled with?
Well, I've covered 7 secretaries of state, and that was over, you know, a few administrations. So I started at the tail end of Madeleine Albright. That was just for a little bit. And then Colin Powell, Condi Rice. So Madeleine Albright, Colin Powell, Condi Rice, Hillary Clinton, John Kerry, Rex Tillerson and Mike Pompeo. So that's 7 secretaries of state, and Clinton, Obama, Bush, Obama, about six presidencies. But you know, met a lot of dignitaries along the way. I've been very fortunate. It's been great. I mean, I love what I do, and I love going out and meeting new people and, you know, learning about different countries. So it's been great.
How do you keep personal relationships intact when your job is to be all over the world at any given moment? What is that like?
I mean, it takes work, just like any relationship. I mean, you know, it's not a I'll see you at home for dinner, dear, kind of life. But, you know, personal relationships take work. And as we were saying about, you know, technology, I mean, that's a great connector. And, you know, we don't write letters the way we used to, but, you know, email and text and, you know, calls and FaceTime and such. You know, my family, my mother and my brother live out west, so I don't get to see them that often. But, you know, I think when you, you know, I think a lot of times we build up personal relationships that aren't really meaningful and we kind of collect them. But I think when a relationship is worth holding on to, like I have friends that I've been friends with for 20 years and I don't speak to them every day, but, you know, the relationship kind of carries until we do reconnect. And when we do, it's like no time has passed. So I think relationships are more about, you know, what you put into them as opposed, it's quality over quantity.
Which is a beautiful segue to, I hear that you met a young lady, wait, I've noted it, one Julie Mason at some point.
Yes.
How long, can you tell us anything about your friendship with young Miss Mason? And do you have any dirt that you can share without you and or her getting into terrible trouble?
Oh, goodness. I met Ms. Mason. I think I met Julie for the first time at a Friendsgiving of Margaret Talev, who was also a regular on the show.
Mm-hmm.
And Margaret Talev, who at the time was with Bloomberg and now she's with Axios. Margaret every year has a Friendsgiving where all friends get together the day or a week after Thanksgiving and have a potluck. So I met her with Kara Lee, another Pooligan favorite. And that's how we met. So we've known each other for a while. Yeah. Any dirt? You know, I'll save that for the next episode.
I was going to say, I'm not really going to push you on that. No, that was really just
I mean,
a joke
but
question.
I will say Julie is a tremendous amount of fun and mm-hmm. you know, she's so witty and so smart and such a good host on Sirius that I probably viewers, listeners have this view of her as being this kind of tough chick. But Julie has a heart of gold. And, you know, I'll tell you one thing that doesn't really say much about that isn't dirt, but I'll tell you something that, you know, says something about Julie. I went out, years ago was doing that online dating. And I had a bad date. And I think, I want to say someone drugged my drink, like gave me like a roofie. Ooh. Or something.
Oh,
the date wasn't going well. So I, you know, was getting I didn't drink much. Like I can handle my liquor, you know? And, and I kind of found my way into an Uber, got home, but I really didn't feel good. And I like had to climb up the stairs and I thought, you know, something's wrong. I don't feel very well. And you know what? Out of all my friends, who did I call that night at like midnight? And we weren't even that close at the time. I called Julie Mason and I said, I think someone drugged me. And she, you know, she offered to come over right away. And, you know, she stayed on the, you know, I didn't think I needed her to come over, but she stayed on the phone with me for quite a long time and calmed me down. And, you know, don't let the humor fool you. Julie Mason has a heart of gold and, you know, is a true, true friend, to all.
Okay. Listeners, you probably didn't learn something you didn't already suspect, but there is a heart of gold underneath all the witticisms and the professionalism.
Yeah,
there is a heart of
yes.
gold. The heart of gold, it usually shows. She usually, it's a tell usually when she starts talking about
animals,
her dog
for
instance.
Or Tonga.
The moment, that, yeah, That's an immediate tell. Also, she frequently speaks ill of children, but then she starts talking about Hudson, and then that is also exposed as potentially not being wholly true.
Look, Julie is you know, Hudson. Hudson is very dear to her. She also makes really good enchiladas.
See, this, the cooking side, we sometimes hear about the cooking side. I feel like we get to hear too little of it.
Apparently she's been dabbling a lot more. So I'm looking at a possible cookbook for her, because now she's cooking a lot for her husband. But I remember one meal, she made some pretty damn good enchiladas. That always stands out to me.
Don't get me wrong. She has mentioned the high standard and quality of her enchiladas on the show before. They have near mythical status.
Well, they live up to the myth. They live up to the myth.
Speaking of enchiladas, how about that Corona situation that we find ourselves in at the moment? How do you handle?
Can use a margarita around now, huh?
Yeah, just around now. It's before 9 a.m. That's margarita time. After 9 a.m., it's more like Jack Daniels on the rocks. Yeah. As a journalist, how do you handle what's going on right now? There is no foreign travel at the moment. There will be for the foreseeable future. Luckily, the larger organizations obviously have foreign correspondents that are in the country that they're reporting from. But other than that, how disruptive do you think this situation will be to reporting?
Very disruptive. Very disruptive, because look, I mean, a lot of what we do in Washington is making calls, you know, yes, but a lot of it is having meetings, secret meetings with sources. But, you know, the vast majority of journalism is getting out and seeing and doing and hearing and feeling and smelling and touching. And so we can't do any of that right now. You know, maybe it's, you know, look, this is the real only story out there. Of course, there are so many horrible things going on around in the world that we, you know, aren't thinking about right now, whether it's Syria or Yemen or, you know, elsewhere. But like, everybody really is riveted on coronavirus. And so that's where the majority of the reporting is going right now. But, you know, maybe media will have a reset. Like, I think, you know, not that there's not a lot of great journalism going out there, but, you know, we've talked a lot amongst our friends and fellow journalists about how media maybe lost its way in the last couple of years. And, you know, this seriousness of this virus might be a chance to kind of do a reset and think about what's important and think about, you know, what we know and what are facts and what aren't facts, and less about kind of interpretation and opinion. Or self-aggrandizement or exploitation, and more about just like what, you know, what we see, what we know, you know, and getting back to how people are affected and not kind of this Trump sucks, let's discuss kind of mentality. Like, whether you like him or not, you know, that's not really the issue. It's about, there's a lot of things going on in the world and we just need to, you know, expand our view a little bit, I think.
I think Trump poses such an, and I'm not a professional, but I would think that Trump poses a really unique challenge, because if you don't point out that things are not as they used to be, you have an issue. So first there's things are not done the way that they used to be done. Then there is, of course, well, was it okay to do things like this in the first place, or is it okay to not do them this way? And then there is some, I think, that has to be acknowledged, blatant lying that has been going on. And that pointing that out too is also tough.
Okay. I don't know if there's blatant lying, but I do think that everybody thinks their interpretation of it is truth. Right? So remember when Kellyanne Conway said something about alternative facts?
Mm-hmm.
Alternative facts. Mm-hmm. She was lying at the time, but you know, people are seeing things in different way. And so I think that's the biggest challenge. Like, if I say something that you don't like, or, you know, that someone doesn't like, all of a sudden they're coming back on Twitter and saying, without even reading it or without even considering it, fake news. That's fake news. Without even thinking that there might be a grain of truth, without looking to see if it's true, without researching it. You know, there's that aspect. There's the aspect of, you know, I think what people have the most problem with President Trump is his personality. I mean, I'm not saying I agree with his policies, because most of them I don't, but it's hard to even have a, you know, but that doesn't stop me from reporting objectively on him or what people, you know, or what voters elected him to do. His supporters are very happy with what he's doing. I mean, he's doing what he was elected to do. And I may, or we all may, you know, the people that, you know, may, that don't support X policy or Y policy, have a problem with that. But I don't think we could start every day and say, what shitty thing. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that on your podcast, but I did.
You're allowed to say whatever you please, at least.
So I don't think we can wake up every day and say, oh, what shitty thing did President Trump do today? And then find a way to maneuver it into, because we don't like him. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying I like him or I don't like him. I'm just saying it's hard to look, because he makes it look, I think he's his worst enemy. I think it's hard to look past his personality to whatever he's doing. You know, at the Council on Foreign Relations, one of, you know, this former Republican ambassador, his name is Robert Brackwell, wrote a report, and it's called Trump's policy, foreign policies aren't as bad as we think. Mm-hmm. And why did he call it that? He called it that because a majority of America just thinks everything he does is bad, because they're not even looking at what it is. They're just looking at how he's delivering it, or the message, or, you know what I mean? Like, that's why I think, and I go back to my original statement earlier, is that, like, we're not used to having someone who's a cult of personality as president. You know, obviously you need to have a huge, healthy ego to want to be president. But there's usually a statesmanship and a soberness that comes with being president that this president doesn't have. And we're not used to it, you know, but I think that the media is doing the best that it can, but it can do better. I'm not normalizing him, and I'm not praising him, and I'm not any of that. It's a vicious cycle where he doesn't think he gets a fair shake. And so he goes, like, towards the, you know, polar opposite of the way he should be going. And then that kind of gets us going more. And it's really impossible. I mean, I think that President Bush had a lot of criticisms about his policy. But, you know, apart from the occasional joke about his intelligence, which, you know, he looks to be a very strong president when you compare. Mm-hmm. To, you know, he's looking better as the years go by, just put it that way, and the way he's comported himself since he's been president. But I don't remember the criticism of him being that ugly. And there were plenty of policies that people criticized him. Okay, Abu Ghraib, the Iraq War, you know, the Quran issue, the black sites. Maybe that was the Obama administration. But anyway, you know, I don't remember it being that personal against I've never seen it this personal. And he invited it and he covets it. But that doesn't mean we need to rise to his challenge and mm-hmm. take his bait.
Because it then feeds into it further. So that, yeah. And that then makes it a really terrible cycle that's not really useful to news telling.
Yeah. He says he doesn't get a fair shake, and he probably doesn't, but he doesn't covet one. He doesn't, it's almost like he doesn't want one, unless you're saying, like, oh, Trump's amazing, Trump's wonderful, Trump's this. I don't think that anybody that is working for him right now, like, says that with a straight face, but, like, there's no honesty on either side. His side or the media's side. Hmm.
How do you think that can be remedied in the short term? Will that only be remedied in a next administration? Should there be a Democratic administration? Will it change if he gets reelected and there will be some sort of reckoning in the media? How do you think this improves?
It's a great question. I think it's going to have to start with him. I think it's going to have to start with him that he wants a better relationship. Well, it needs to, I mean, I think until he's ready for like an honest kind of sober assessment of his presidency and is willing, look, he doesn't take advice from his aides. And although now with the coronavirus, he does seem to, and that, you know, I'll say one thing. A friend of mine, Dana Bash at CNN, got in a lot of trouble for saying some stuff on CNN that, like, you know, that the president's change in tone yesterday was, was dramatic and remarkable and needs to be encouraged. And everybody came back to her and said, oh, you're normalizing him. You're, you know, he lies and you're just like papering it over and all this. And I don't think that's what she was doing. What she was doing, and this is what I'm saying, is you need to meet people where they're at. You can't hold, you know what I mean? You need to meet them where they're at. This person did X. Deal with the X. Don't deal with all the baggage that came before that. And maybe if you start encouraging good behavior, this is maybe the way we change it. If you start encouraging good behavior, it's like a child, right? Or a dog. I mean, I'm not saying the president's a dog listener. I'm saying that there's a Pavlovian response. If you encourage good behavior, more good behavior will come because they're being rewarded. And what does President Trump want? He wants to be rewarded with praise. So if he does something that's like nominally good, you know, like encourage more, you know, good boy, let's keep it going. And so that's maybe how, you know, if he sees his numbers going up with his good behavior, then maybe he'll continue that good behavior. And so yes, there are a lot of problems with this administration and this presidency, but, you know, instead of just sitting and bitching and whining about it, let's try to encourage better behavior and see what happens. Like, what we've been doing for the last 3 years is not working. So, you know, not everything the guy does if it's marginally good, which grade does he get? The high or the low? Like, encourage better behavior and let's try some, maybe that's the experiment. You know what I mean? Like, you need to treat people where they are, and where we are is this guy needs a lot of praise. So let's encourage behavior that gives him praise.
Well, I think it's the press has never.
That was a long rant, but.
No, that's perfect. No, I'm great. We're here for the long rants. This is what podcasts are for, Elise. Long rants about interesting things. That is what we're here for. I guess I'm confounded as a non-professional. I'm confounded by the idea that it would be the business, or would have to be the business of journalists to praise a president in order in the hopes that things might improve. Like you said, sort of akin, not that anybody calls him that, but sort of akin to either a small child or potentially a puppy that you're trying to train. This is new. As you said earlier, Americans have a certain image of a president, and I guess so does the press. And this was not traditionally, over the last 20 years, necessarily one of the things that anybody was really thinking about.
We need to just meet people where they are.
Yeah.
We can't, this is the president we have. And, you know, who knows? We could have him for another 4 years. Who knows?
Julie keeps pointing out that is a distinct possibility.
It's a distinct possibility. Let's see. I mean, what this coronavirus does, if it's a, you know, I think a lot of people were willing to overlook the things they didn't like about him because the economy was really humming. Mm-hmm. And now it's not going to be humming. So, I mean, it's any, you know, this, just like I would, you know, just like people said, I can't imagine President Trump being elected. Well, guess what? He was elected. And, you know, 6 months ago, people were like, oh my God, he's definitely going to win. You know, I think the last few years have taught us that we can't predict anything. And anybody that says that they can't. Nobody has answers to anything right now. So if you think you do, unless you're like an epidemiologist, like, you know, you don't know anything. And neither do I. Neither do I.
Just to illustrate your point that nobody knows anything and things are can be somewhat surprising, during the time that we talked, which was not an hour, there have been two bits of news. Number one, Bernie Sanders is suspending his campaign. And number two, the Treasury announced that it will give, and I don't want to misinform the adoring public, the Treasury proposal is that they will deliver $500 billion in checks to millions of Americans first round coming April 6th. So if anybody would have mentioned that about an hour ago, people would, I know, where are those checks? $500 billion. It's like everybody won the lottery now that the coronavirus has started. Everybody's winning the lottery.
No, it's not a lottery. It's, look, hardworking Americans shouldn't be punished for this virus. And everybody has a responsibility. Everybody is in, I think a good way to look at it is every American is in the U.S. Army right now fighting this virus. And, you know, they need to be, you know, it's going to be really hard. So, you know, they shouldn't suffer. And if the economy, you know, in order to keep the economy afloat and keep, you know, hardworking Americans, I'm not worried. You know, yesterday, I thought it was really interesting that Mnuchin said, obviously, we don't need to give a check to someone who makes $1 million. That's true. But it was a remarkable statement from an administration that, like, usually favors the rich. Okay. Can we reward, like, not reward them, but what can we acknowledge that this administration is starting to wake up to the fact that hardworking Americans are the ones that keep this economy running and that they need to be taken care of? Yeah, we can. And I think, you know, is it going to be enough? Probably not. But, you know, I'm glad this is something that Andrew Yang has been talking about for months. Like, now his, you know, I was talking to him just yesterday and his phone is blowing up. Because he was the one that was talking about just giving Americans money, you know, as part of the income dividend. But now that they're starting to wake up to it, this was an idea that he had. So, I mean, it's an idea that should be applauded, I think. You know, no, it's, you know, let's not have the attitude, oh, well, it's the least they can do. They're doing it and we should be grateful.
Yeah, no, I did not mean to be overly sarcastic. I have a mom who's immunocompromised and I have a daughter who's immunocompromised. So it is 100% in my best interest.
Me too. My mom is, I lock my mom down. My mom is immunocompromised in Arizona and I wish I could go out and see her, but I'm not going to take the risk. So I'm locking her down.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, you have to. My mom just went through breast cancer treatment here in LA. And so she's staying with us. And it's really challenging. And my daughter also has cancer, also on lockdown because of the same same situation. So I get the idea of that people really need help and that that it's important. My cynicism, which is maybe misplaced, comes more from a place of, now we are having like a number, sort of a round, pretty number, the kind of thing that Trump seems to favor of $500 billion and everybody's getting a check, when in reality, or additionally perhaps to that being necessary, and it is undeniably necessary for a tremendous amount of people. But in addition to said, the idea that the administration is not able to cogently, especially the president, is not able to cogently address what's going on, what has gone wrong, why the testing should be improved immediately in as speedy of a fashion as humanly possible, is difficult for me to comprehend. And we have friends in Italy. We've seen what happens in Italy. They are absolutely petrified and terrified. And there has been, it's clear that little testing has led to more trouble. And now we're in a situation where that little testing is exactly what's happening in America. And I'm terrified of it going the way of Italy. I guess that's where my perhaps misplaced.
Yeah, no, and obviously, obviously that, Yeah, no. Obviously, the administration didn't kind of seize the importance and the moment early enough. You know, it's clear. And I think, they were warned about this in early January. And I think what's really interesting is that usually the US is the one that kind of takes the lead on these pandemics. When you saw what happened with Ebola, like the US kind of led the worldwide response. And now we're, on the back foot, which is, says a lot about US leadership in the world. And I think that's, obviously really important. And I think the fact that the administration did not seize that moment really, prevented and or kind of delayed our response and is going to make it a lot worse in the end. But again, they're doing it now. So I'm not happy with the response up till now, but that doesn't mean I can't look at what they're doing now and say, okay, finally, thank God, instead of saying, well, it's too
Got that at
little,
some
too
point.
late, I think it's important that they're doing it now, and that's where I have to meet them.
Absolutely. At least now that we know that there is no more Bernie Sanders in the running, what is your impression of what Vice President Biden can do? Do you think he is the guy to somehow steady a ship, if that is even something that would be considered necessary? What is your experience with Vice President Biden, and is he the man for this job?
I'm not going to say whether he's the right man for the job. I do think he's projecting a lot of confidence, and I think, in statesmanship and what people are looking for in, as we said before, that kind of traditional kind of statesmanlike. In a crisis, you kind of go to the warm blanket, right? You go to, that steady hand, and I think that's why you've seen this kind of clean sweep that he's having. In the primaries, because people think he's more electable. And why do they think he's more electable? Because we're in a crisis and he projects this kind of calm, steady hand. People don't want a revolution right now. They want normal. And so I think he projects normal. I think it's really going to go down to how, I mean, I do think, for whatever people thought of his presidency for the last 3 years, I do think that Donald Trump is going to be elected, reelected, or lose based on how he handles the crisis going forward. If, he's able to get this stimulus and the economy picks up and he's able to stem the tide, then, Biden will have an uphill battle. But if he, if the, people were, as I said, willing to kind of overlook some of his flaws because the economy was humming, it's not going to be humming. So I think it's going to be an uphill battle for him to get reelected now because what's on top of mind is the coronavirus. And so how he deals with it is really going to be, I think, his legacy.
That's a really excellent point. And on that, Elise, thank you so much for doing this podcast, for being willing to come here, to keep reconnecting while my software was doing things that it was clearly not supposed to be
That's,
doing.
oh, it's my pleasure. And I just, the Pooligans are awesome. Every time I'm on with Julie, it's such an engaging and supportive audience. And so, thanks for supporting Julie and thanks for supporting me.
Thank you. And you can follow, of course, Elise Labbett, which I'm sure you already are. But if you're not, then you will immediately follow her at Elise Labbett on Twitter. And you will also be looking out for her forthcoming, yet to be named podcast. And if you have ideas for Elise's podcast name, then you can submit those either under the podcast when we post it or directly at Elise Labbett. Elise, thank you so much.
Thanks, guys.